Blog Talk Radio.
This is our final episode in our Oscar nominee interview series. Oscar season is finally about to wind down.
Finally.
It's been a long one.
It has been. It does seem that way, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Oh, God.
I mean, between this this season and all the political debates, I mean, it's like nonstop campaigning.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. It is nonstop campaigning.
It never ends. But yeah, we're reaching an end of it, and we got a great guest tonight, Ludovic Bors. He is the Oscar nominated composer of The Artist,
mm-hmm.
the Oscar darling this year, and come Monday morning, I'm sure we're going to see that it really was the Oscar darling.
Yeah,
I think he's an odds-on favorite to win this particular category too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And an interesting interview. Let me tell you, this is the first time we've called out to France.
Oh,
we've
cool.
We've called out to, you know, we've done lots of England, called out to England and a lot for Kubrick.
Right.
But he was in Paris. That's where he lives, obviously. But he's not flying into L.A. until Saturday. And it was the first time also that I submitted my questions in advance. Because I never even write down questions. I've stopped doing that a long time ago.
Okay.
So, I mean, I just talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I needed to because he's just learning the language.
Right, okay.
So he's a really charming, very talented guy with some great things to say about the art of film composition and for silent cinema as well. I mean, that's an interesting thing, is it... Does your music have to work harder
mm-hmm.
for a silent movie, a non-dialogue movie? You know,
right. Mm-hmm.
Does it have to fill in the gaps? That,
right.
You know? It's interesting. So he answers that in this interview tonight. Jerry, how are you, man?
I'm fine. How are you doing? I mean,
I like it how
really,
we get,
really, how are you doing?
We get 5 minutes into the conversation, and I finally say hi.
No,
how you doing?
It's fine. I mean, we're doing a show Sunday, right? Right before the Oscars.
It's probably just an hour, like from 6 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
I think just like pre-show and, you know, last kind of thoughts. And,
okay. All right. Well, we'll save all that for then. Okay.
Yeah, and you can tell us what you're wearing.
Great. That's wonderful. We want to keep people on the show.
What designer are you wearing tonight, Jerry? That's a beautiful gown.
Yeah, that is. Thank you. I aim to please.
Yeah. Well. So, did you see anything? I'm so out of it.
I saw something that I. All right. My niece was home. My brother and his daughter were home for the weekend.
And how old's your niece?
And my niece is 11.
Okay.
I think she's 11. Yeah, she's 11.
She's a young girl.
We were going to go see the anime movie, The World of Ariadne. That's what I really wanted to see that. My brother's like, no, you'll have plenty of time. I'm like, no, dude, I work on Monday. I'm not going to, you'll take it to see the movie with The Rock, The Journey to the Mysterious Island.
Right.
Yeah, oh, my God, dude. Thank God I got them in for free because, I mean, with the 3D glasses in it, oh, my God.
Unbearable.
Well, not unbearable. I mean, I like The Rock. But my mom turned to me and said, Michael Caine was absolutely, wasn't kidding. He is a working actor. He'll be an anime. My mom turned to me.
He always has been, man.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
but I'm just like, I'm watching it, and I'm just like, you know, this is like the outtakes from Land of the Lost, not the series, the movie. I like The Rock. I mean, but I thought this was for him slumming. I didn't realize.
Well, it's a decision to appeal to a family audience, and family movies
doing that.
Do well.
Doing that. Oh, and it's done very well. You can't dispute that.
There's something to be said, though. Working actor. I think Michael Caine is probably as good as he is, not only because he's been doing it so long,
right?
Because he's been doing so much that he's even learned how to finesse his way through Drek unscathed. And I think that has to sharpen your skills when you're in something so unconvincing, and you can make it convincing. That's a special gift.
No, that is. No, I mean, it's all right. I mean, but it's obviously better than the movie that he did with the shark, Jaws the Revenge. I mean, that's one of those definite low points. But I know we've had this conversation on the show before over the years. It did make me miss, though, the movie that it's obviously based on, The Mysterious Island, the original one. I think some of the digital effects are really neat in a lot of these movies, but this made me miss, like, all the old, like, stop motion. Mm. Just the nostalgia factor, I guess.
Here's a question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sound came in, when was The Jazz Singer? What year was that?
Isn't that 28? Is that 1928?
Yeah, so it came in over 80 years ago.
Right.
So decades from now, is there going to be, and now the front runner for Best Picture is The Artist, a silent movie. So decades from now, are we going to have a Best Picture that uses, you know, the Clash of the old Clash of the Titans, Jason and the Argonauts type stop motion? is that going to feel new again?
I don't know. They showed a trailer. They made a sequel to the Clash of the Titans, Wrath of the Titans. But that, I hate to say, that looks like a retread of that other the movie that came out last year, Immortals, with Mickey Rourke almost.
Yeah. The next one would be called Fury of the Titans.
Fury of the Titans, Revenge of the Titans.
Yeah.
Bad Day of the Titans.
Yeah. Generally awful mood of the Titans.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But they showed the trailer for The Hobbit. That looks good.
I got to tell you, looking at the release schedule, it's anemic. I mean, there's very little that I'm looking forward to, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really start to get good, I guess, until this summer and maybe April, because you have Whit Stillman has a new movie, Damsels in Distress, and then you have, like, May and June. But I tell you, the fall looks incredible. But right now, though, no, you're absolutely right. It's just like... What I mean, The Lorax, really? I mean, no, but I am curious.
Sounds
John
like a lack
Carter.
Yeah.
John Carter. I read an article, I guess, the Daily Beast yesterday, and $250 million. Really? I mean, it looks like Cowboys and Aliens, kind of. You know.
I think they're going to lose their shirt on that, and just look at the money they're spending on marketing as well. Adding on to that.
I would never have told me. I know I read those books as a kid and everything, but I hope they're not using that as the basis, because I don't know a lot of people even know who John Carter. I mean, you know, I don't think the average moviegoer, when they see that photo, who's John Carter, you know? I mean,
yeah.
It's not name brand. I don't mean to say sound like that, but I just think that's a lot of money to put on a not a proven household name.
It's interesting how they took out the From Mars part of the title, too.
Yeah.
Which is similar to what they did with Hugo, because the title of that was the invention of Hugo Cabret,
right.
And then it changed to Hugo Cabret, and then just Hugo. And then, yeah, I was expecting what's next, like H period, you know?
Yeah,
I didn't know. Okay, later on tonight we're going to premiere a film score. I'm not sure which one. Maybe Badly Drawn Boy's new score to that movie, Being Flynn. Which I hear is a great De Niro performance. It's like a fully engaged De Niro performance in that
movie.
Well,
that would be nice.
Yeah. And a little piece of an interview we did with cinematographer Rick Waite, who passed away this past weekend. I think we did the final interview with him because he didn't like to do interviews. And we interviewed him for our Cobra show.
Right, yeah.
Of all things, summer of 86, and he was a great conversationalist.
Yeah,
so
that was.
We'll close the show with a snippet of that. And do a little movie news in between, try to get out of here at a decent time.
Okay, all
right. You know what I got to do tomorrow? You'll never guess where I'm going tomorrow. I took the day off work.
Oh, God, where are you going?
I am going with my friend and to NASCAR.
Oh, okay.
The last place that you would expect me to be.
Right, but it's just fun. I mean, come on, dude.
Yeah. But
it's a lot of fun.
My friend loves NASCAR, and he's always kind of begged me to go with him. So I said, all right, I'll take the day off.
Cool.
And then but the Daytona 500 is Sunday, and I was like, no way, not going to that because I'm not going to miss the Oscars.
Right, right.
But this is some kind of preliminary placement thing, relay, Gatorade, something.
Oh,
anyway,
cool.
it'll be a new experience. So I'll come back with so many great stories.
No, I definitely want to hear this. That's cool. That's good for you. No, that's good. It's new. It's something new and exciting to do. So
I live in Florida, and it's very, very seldom that I actually go out to a place or seek out an event that reflects the red state I live in. So this will be interesting. But, okay, let's go ahead and play our featured interview of the evening, and then we'll come back with lots more goodies.
Okay, cool.
Ludovic Bors, Best Original Score nominee for his work in The Artist. The Artist is actually his fourth movie with director Michel Hazanavicius, so they're close collaborators. And you could tell, like, the kind of the sense of wonder that he has, that he's been a musician all of his life. He composes films here and there. And all of a sudden, because of this movie, I mean, everyone involved in this movie, really, is being thrust into the Hollywood spotlight. And particularly relevant because it's a movie that celebrates old Hollywood.
Right.
And there's another theory going around about why people are finding The Artist so appealing, and I'll talk to you about it after this after the interview. I think it's an interesting track. So here is Ludovic speaking about his experiences being nominated and working on The Artist. So tell me, you're days away from the Oscars. How are you feeling? Are you excited or nervous?
No. First of all, I'm waiting very well. I have no stress. I'm so excited, maybe, but not nervous or not scared about anything. Each day, each hours and seconds. I live the present time. It's the most important for me to think about that and live the present time, the present moment, for just because in 6 days everything will be finished. So I don't know what's happening, but I'm very enjoyed to be nominated to on the EMFAS. So it's just unbelievable for a young French composer as me, and I'm very honored to come Saturday in LA.
Well, your music is fantastic. I adore it. But
thank you.
Tell me about music and music and film. You started playing and writing at an early age, I'm sure, but was film music an important part of your life at that point?
Not because, for me, music is music. And in fact, I could understand what you mean about my works and my music on the silent movie as The Artist, But music is music, you know. For me, it's a pleasure, joy. It's a joy every time I have a good screenplay to meet a director or a producer or team who have a good project, you know. Mm-hmm. But music, it's music, and music is sometimes accompanied. It's in English the pictures, you know. So for me, it's a part of my my career to make the best I could I can on the film movie. But I have many other projects without pictures or you understand. So for me to. If you mean about what I used for the early, the last century, what I appreciate most on the artist, it's to make a tribute for the your culture. That is the same thing. So for Michel and the director. Of the artist, so we are very passionate, and mm-hmm. we have to make a tribute and a declaration of love for your Hollywood style.
And it's a great Hollywood, old Hollywood sounding score too.
Oh,
that
thank you.
But tell me about, because composing for a silent film has to be a bit different from a dialogue film.
Not at all. In fact, we had many interrogations just before to compose anything. Before the screenplay Michel made, we had many afternoon of work together. And we watched many silent movie, speaking movie, everything on earth, many romantic music, as Tchaikovsky or French composer as Ravel or Debussy, and for sure the legendary composers as Franz Waxman, Alfred Newman, Mike Steiner, to Bernard Herrmann. So the first is not different as a movie with a dialogue or sound effects or I don't know. So you just try to find the good point or the good choice of the general atmosphere on a sequence or on a narrative block. In fact, we were very close with Michel to find a big sequences or big narrative block atmosphere from music. So it, for us, it was only the first way of work. In fact, but it's the same processus. A composer is a musician. A composer translate what he feels every day. So if he has the possibilities to add some pictures or film, he traduces his own personalities and styles and emotion. So music is only emotion. So he translates only what he feels. So with dialogue or without dialogue, it's the same processes, in fact.
Mm. Well, you mentioned
the same process. I said processus in French. You understand processus?
I understand. You mentioned a couple of composers, legendary composers, Max Steiner and Bernard Herrmann.
Oh.
Now tell me about
Congo Volgong. Wait.
Oh yeah.
Sorry.
Tell me about the use of the brief clip of Herman's Vertigo in the movie. Why did you make that choice?
No, in fact, you know, we were oppressed by the time every day because the producer needed to present on the movie the artist in on the Festival of Cannes in south of France,
mm-hmm.
And the international film festival of Cannes. So we were pressed by the time with Michel to finish the movie. I started to compose the music at the same time of the editing. So it was in December, and we recorded the music at the end of March or early in April. So. It was very, very, very difficult because to follow the music each day and each week, and when the editing cuts are changing, you must to remake or re-editing your music, and it doesn't work. You make another. You must to compose another way, another music. So it was impossible. That's why. And Michel, when he had some test projection with the French team, the producer and the sponsor support producer, as Harvey Weinstein, so the movie in January just 1:30 months after the beginning of the editing, so it has been only 30% of music, and Michel needed some to present as best he could with the track 10 as Vertigo. That's why Michel put very early on the cuts and the editing the Vertigo scène d'amour, love scene of Vertigo in this sequence. It's the last sequence of the artist of the dot. You know, the composer knows exactly what's happening when a director puts a temporary track. And in fact, a temporary track is not a temporary track, but a legendary music as Bernard Herrmann. So I told to Michel, so yo, I'm condemned, I could do my best, but it's impossible to replace it, Bernard Herrmann. So keep this version.
Well, what did I mean? Just that little. That little bit, that little taste of Herman's score, I mean, it's a great salute to the old Hollywood music, and it fits so perfectly. It fits right in with the score that you composed for the movie. I mean, it's perfect.
I don't know. It's perfect, but it was very, very hard to because since I worked with Michel since 16 years now. 16 years. I mean, we have the same sensibilities, and we share since few years. Many things. We share many information of the life. In fact, so we are very close because we are friends and friends. So. I don't know exactly why sometimes happened on this process of creation in the artist. In fact, I don't know if we knew something about what's happening in the last month, because everybody's around us was crazy. We were to recreate every day everything. Well, to finish the movie and the music on time for the Festival of Cannes last May.
Yeah. Well, do you think, because the artist has become so wildly popular, people love it, they've really taken it into their hearts, why do you think that is?
I had a chance to come in your country and meet so many people, fantastic people, really love the movie. I can analyze after I come back to Paris that why they love so much the movie, because I think on the art there is no valiant of fighting, you know, scenes or sequence. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's only a romanticism and love story. On that, this translation of the love what needs people in the world about economic crisis for each people in this world is very, very hard. On maybe they. They feel some breath of love with our works, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read something that there's going to be a live tour with the artist and your score.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are prepared some. We try to make a good organization around about. The world tour, and we have many opportunities in the world, but it's very for the moment we don't know exactly which orchestra or it's very soon to speak about that, because we don't know exactly when the possibilities to have the authorization from the local distributors in each country all over the world, and everything is fast for this organization. So I had to take after the Oscars, we will see what's happening with the world tour or film concert and with the artists. But it's possible. We have many possibilities to make many film concerts in the world.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to the nominee luncheon in Los Angeles?
Yeah, for sure.
Did were you able to meet the your fellow composers?
I don't. I already met Alberto Iglesias, the Spanish composer, in Berlin, last December. I met Mr. Shaw, Howard Shaw, first time it was on the studio of Hans Zimmer in Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. And Zimmer is a very generous guy. He's a fantastic person. He received me as a brother. And so I thank you so much. He's a very a big guy, great. Wonderful as Mr. Shaw too, because I have many love of his work as Alberto too, and Mr. Williams for sure. For me, it's unbelievable to be on the same and we are in the same place for this nomination. Mm. But John Williams, in fact, it was not in the Lucian of nominees. So I met Mr. Spielberg, and I tell him about, well, it's Mr. Williams, I need to meet him. Wait, I have many questions to do. Don't worry. John is on a studio in Spain, is on a Steinway. I can't to hear anything. It's impossible. it was just fantastic to meet Mr. Spielberg. He was so nice too, very adorable person. And he said to me, okay, you see John at your Oscar ceremony. So I cross a finger to have 1 minute. So I don't know. I want to have some words about what I think about my music, because I have so many things to so many so many love to give him because I for me it's the last genius of Hollywood composer.
Mm, I agree. Yeah, and that must be exciting. So tell me what you're working on now.
I'm working on a promotional, like you, interviews the very early of the morning and to the night. But I don't have any time for me now because you know just since the Golden Globes everything's changing for me, so I have many interviews all over the world. So it's unusual for me because nobody knows me.
Mm.
So it's incredible. I hope. Next Monday, next week, I hope to return to my piano, and I have so many things to tell with my music. So I really want to return to compose that because with this gratitude you gave me with in the USA, and so it's for me. I could express what I received since the last two months.
Mm. Well, your music is gorgeous. It's beautiful, and I thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, because you know, for me, when I was in my little studio, I work every day for sure as many composers, but. You know, sometimes it was very, very hard to have the spirit of Korngold, of Shiner, of Waxman, of Tom Kim, or Rosla, or I don't know, all the great American composers from the Golden Age. So I pray every night, Max, please help me. What could you compose on this part? Also, on sometimes was Korngold, another night Newman or Waxman. I don't know. I implored, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's English word, the sky and the spirit, and I asked to the spirit of the composer to help me sometimes. But I really love the wonderful composer, as I said.
Thank you.
Okay, that is Ludovic Bors, composer of The Artist. And
that was
pretty
awesome.
I
liked it. That was very enjoyable. Awesome interview.
Thanks. I think it's cool that that he's, you know, hobnobbing with Spielberg and Howard Shore and,
mm-hmm.
you know, everybody at the Oscars. He's like, where's John Williams? Yeah. I mean, that's great. So here's my theory on The Artist. At least from a movie industry
mm-hmm.
point of view.
Okay.
What is The Artist about? I mean, it's like, it's sound is coming in,
mm-hmm.
right? They feel threatened with that.
Right.
What are we dealing with today?
There you go.
I mean, we're dealing with like major movie industry changes, like the a future evolution in terms of IMAX 3D,
mm-hmm.
all the challenges and promises that holds. I mean, so I think if there's any relevance at all in terms of Oscar voters, if The Artist has any relevance, it's that.
That's a great point. I didn't even think of that. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. You also have the internet.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a whole other thing that no one knows how to really make that work yet. You have Netflix, and now you had the announcement today that Comcast is going to try to challenge Netflix in that department with the streaming on the internet
mm-hmm.
and everything. So you have that. I think, though, with the IMAX and the 3D, that, I guess, to an extent, is saving the theaters. Especially, I mean, if you have successes like the Mission Impossible film in IMAX, I mean, and
yeah.
obviously The Dark Knight Rises will be the next, I would imagine, the huge, will be the, I think that will be the game changer as far as IMAX.
I guess they just put, they just passed through legislation that they've been working on forever with China.
Mm-hmm.
Which means a lot for IMAX screens. I mean, there's going to be a lot more IMAX screens in China because they had a restriction that they could only release so many U.S. films
right.
a year in mm-hmm. in China. So the movie industry celebrating that because
that's a lot of gross, but that's another interesting point to bring up. Are movies, you know, for the longest time, there's certain genres that didn't play well overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's completely different. I mean, you had The Hangover 2 actually made more money overseas than it made here. And that's very rare because our comedies don't normally
right.
do well. And then you have things like The Pirates of the Caribbean or Harry Potter and things like that, where they're making a huge chunk of their change overseas now. It's almost like the U.S. market doesn't even count. They're not even worried about whether... Tintin is a perfect example.
Right.
So that's another thing. So, I mean, I think... Yeah, no, it's a good point, Jamie. It's a really good point.
That's about time I make one.
No, you make a lot of good points. So that was good. That's a very good... In relation to The Artist, that's good.
Well, because everyone talks about The Artist being a slight movie, and it is in that it's not... extrovertly dealing with any kind of issues or life and death or, you know, it's not a... It's a light movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of people's minds, that makes it less deserving of an Oscar for Best Picture.
But
what was the last light movie to win?
That's a good point. Last year it was The King's Speech, and that was definitely not a light movie. You had No Country for Old Men, The Departed. you know,
that laugh a minute, No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, I know, really.
People walked out with smiles on their faces.
I know,
that one
really.
Too,
you were just dancing in the aisles for that one. no, but now speaking of that, though, you know, there's a lot of people coming out against The Help recently. A lot of people, high-profile people, don't like it. Think it's,
yeah.
you know, because it's and one of the things they're saying, one of the reasons they don't like it is because it's the white character that is, like, comes in and, like, unifies everything, and they don't, you know, so.
Yeah, and, you know, I fundamentally don't think that's what the movie is.
No, I don't either. I agree.
Because she doesn't do anything for them.
No.
I mean, they're empowered by telling their own story.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, exactly.
So I really think who, all the people criticizing the film aren't watching the film.
No,
for
I,
what
I
it
agree.
Is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it would be, if the artist gets it, the artist gets it, and if, because of, I mean, maybe it's about time something. Then if it is light, considered light entertainment, then maybe it's about time something
yeah.
enjoyable, something that was. Got it. Because I don't. On, you know, the other, on the other hand, though, if Midnight in Paris got it, which is, I think, a long shot. That would be all right. Maybe
another,
not a long shot,
yeah,
though. I mean,
another great light movie, but
yeah.
but more about something. I mean, it definitely has. It has a theme that could be handled very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. I mean,
right.
it's handled with a light touch, but you can see that being. That kind of theme of nostalgia and, you know, your life kind of,
right.
You're wanting to get out of the times that you're in, and you can see it being done in a different way, maybe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If it was anyone but Woody Allen behind it. And then, but Hugo, I mean, Hugo is a joy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So any of these, but I don't know what could really... Yeah. derail the artist at this point.
It does seem like the most predictable. But, I mean, I filled out my ballot today, and I did look at a couple of categories, and I thought, man, you know, something could surprise here, but I went with... in years previous, I've always said, I'm going to go with, you know, a surprise that I think will happen. But now, this, I've learned my lesson, because I always lose out on those categories. So this year, I'm going with what's expected.
Right,
you know?
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So the artists, like, basically across the board. Here's something Oscar-related. Sacha Baron Cohen wants to go to the Oscars dressed in his role as the dictator, which
mm-hmm.
is from his new film. It was reported earlier today that the Oscars banned him, and then the Oscars came back and said, we didn't ban him. We just told him, if you want to go as this character and cause trouble on the red carpet, we'd prefer you not to be here. We'd prefer you not to do that. We won't let you do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's a, you know, so obviously a big publicity stunt. The largest audience on a world stage,
mm-hmm.
all eyes on him, a great promotion for his movie. So I don't, that probably won't happen.
Right.
Edgar Wright, his next movie is all set up.
Yes. Yeah, so that, now this is, now let me, is this based on the TV show, The Night Stalker?
Yes.
Okay. And with Johnny Depp?
That's my understanding. Yeah,
okay,
Edgar Wright doing that. That's an exciting development.
That is a good development, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
It's good
that he
him.
Got, yeah, you know, it's he's a great, visionary, fun director. So
yeah,
it's good.
He is. It's perfect for him.
They're writing a movie for Tom Cruise's character in Tropic Thunder, a spinoff just about his character.
Wow, okay, this is the second time that something like this has happened from a movie. The first time, I guess, was from that, you know, the Forgetting Sarah Marshall, the Russell Brand character, they wrote a movie for him. Okay, so, the Tom Cruise, it could work. It could. It could.
Yeah.
I don't see why not.
I mean, people love Tom Cruise again.
Yeah. Hey, you know what they say? They say he saved Hollywood.
Yeah.
They really are saying that the Mission Impossible really, and it actually was, it's a terrific film. I mean, I really enjoyed that.
I adore it, too.
Yeah.
But,
you
think he's a big, I mean, financially, in spite of any problems he's had in recent years, career-wide, he is the most financially successful star
mm-hmm.
in history.
Right.
He is. He's made more money from his films than anyone. Across any kind of entertainment platform.
Wow. Okay.
Even music. I mean, you think of the legendary music artist.
Mm-hmm.
His movies have made more money collectively than, you know, and I think I'm right about this, like the Beatles or anyone like that.
Holy
so, which essentially makes him the biggest star in the history of the world.
Okay.
I mean, if you want to put that fine point on it. But, and I thought that was incorrect, but I read, like, several sources that confirmed that. I
mm-hmm.
heard that, like, many months ago, and I thought, really? And Mission Impossible 4 is his single most highest-grossing film.
Wow,
and he's,
okay.
So he's back, you know, in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Wow, no, that's good. So, and he's got the Jack Reacher movie and the Rock of Ages, or...
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
This actor... I know he's popular from Seinfeld.
Oh yeah, I just saw this before we went on the air. So
his name is Daniel von Bargen.
Mm-hmm.
Bargen. I always have him in my mind because I never watched Seinfeld. I always have him in my mind from Basic Instinct. He was the major adversarial detective against
Michael
Douglas.
Oh yeah,
Michael
he always
Douglas.
Gave him a hard time. Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
He attempted suicide. He shot himself in the temple.
Oh God.
And it didn't work. And then he called 911. And so he's in critical condition. But you know.
Oh my God. Okay.
That was news today. Not happy news.
No, not at all. No.
All right. Independent Spirit Awards happened on Saturday. Saturday night.
What time do those come on?
They take place, I believe, 10 p.m. Eastern.
Okay.
7 p.m. Pacific. Seth Rogen is hosting them. If you go to the Movie Geeks United Twitter page, twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, we'll be live tweeting the Indy Spirit Awards, and we'll do the Oscars, too, so if you want to do some conversations with us during those events. So that's good.
All right.
What other news is happening? I'm looking. I'm looking through our Twitter right now to see some other news. There's a new documentary called Bully.
Okay. Not to be confused with the Larry Clark film, Bully.
No.
Okay.
But it's about school bullying, which is a major epidemic now with serious consequences. The Weinstein Company, I guess, is behind the documentary, and the MPAA gave it an R rating. And so they're fighting that rating, saying that the movie has definite social relevance and value that the R rating will harm.
Hmm.
Do you buy that? Do you think that's...
I'm not sure. I'd have to... I mean, let me ask you this. What is the... Do they focus on a specific school or a specific county or state or?
And I don't know the specifics of the movie. I just know that it deals with the epidemic and the serious nature of it to kind of open people's eyes to. I mean, it's definitely a socially relevant
mm-hmm.
documentary.
Yeah,
but
no, definitely.
Where does the rating fall in on that? You know.
Yeah. Well, you need your target audience
is
to be allowed to see the movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, exactly.
And maybe it's something that should not be rated and something that maybe, you know, that should be shown in schools all over the country.
That's an interesting predicament.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah,
obviously
it is.
it's about bullying, so you would expect there to be some abrasive stuff in it.
Right, mm-hmm.
But kids need to see the consequences of
right,
that kind
of thing.
Right, of course. So it could be a valuable movie.
Right.
So I think the ratings board really needs to take a look at it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
A new study shows that piracy has very little impact on box office results in the U.S., less so internationally. It does have impact internationally. But that's the important part, because the international grosses, which is something this study does not say, the international grosses are the bread and butter. I mean, they usually double
right.
most films. The U.S. grosses, so piracy is still a problem.
Yeah, it is. But what do you can't? How do you, you know, you're once you're outside United States, you know, that's very hard to enforce. I mean, I know people that go overseas all the time and they bring back tons of pirated movies. So I just don't.
Yeah.
I don't know how you enforce that. I'm not saying it's right, but I just don't know how you enforce that.
Joel Schumacher said, last time we spoke to him, he said, you know, I forget where it was someplace like Taiwan or something. Instead of like top five box office grosses there or something, they have a list that says top five pirated movies.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his movies, the one that he made about the designer drug, I forget what it's called, 11 maybe or 12, or he said – before that even came out in the U.S., it was the number one pirated movie in Taiwan.
Oh, wow.
And he was flattered by it. He said, well, I just want people to see my movies. You know, but he's not the studio that spent, you know, $15-20 million to make that movie. But I thought it was an interesting. Michael Mann. Let's see, John Logan and Michael Mann. Let me read a little bit of that of this article.
Okay.
They were collaborating on a project. Let's see. Here's a fantasy pick for Best Picture 2011, a fantastically entertaining and original movie with a different perspective on the film industry, a movie that presents cinema not as the dream factory of Hugo or The Artist, but as one of the film's characters aptly describes it, as a river of money. Unfortunately, you can't see this film in theaters. It wasn't just snubbed by the Academy or critics or audiences, but by the studios themselves. It's a movie that doesn't exist because no one made it, though they nearly did. Director Michael Mann and writer John Logan,
mm-hmm.
who wrote Hugo, collaborated on the screenplay. It's said to be the best thing that either one of them ever did, a great film noir, a great Los Angeles movie, and a great film about Hollywood itself, but they never shot a frame of it because it was realistic about the business.
Mm.
Another interesting thing.
Yeah.
What studio is going to finance a movie that criticizes the way studios finance movies?
Right, yeah. I mean, that's going to be a hard thing. That's going to have to be an independent film. I mean...
Yeah. That would be an interesting project, though.
Buffett to finance it.
I mean, I'm all for a great L.A. film noir from
right.
Michael Mann. I mean, that's the bomb jiggity right there, man.
Right, yeah, that would be... I would love to see, you know, Roland, I was texting Roland, we would love to see one great Michael Mann movie, last great Michael
Again,
Mann
yeah.
film.
Yeah, that would be nice. It's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't go see Phantom Menace. Do you think you think it's a success at $30-something million
Yes,
so far?
I do. I know people that have seen it and they liked it, and Dude, it's just like, all right, so it's in 3D. Is that really going to – that's not going to help the things that are wrong with the movie, I think.
It should top out at like $40 million.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's good. I mean, it's not – the initial re-releases – I mean, it's not what the original films would do.
No, the original – when those do come out, those I think will do very well.
Mm-hmm.
I just have no interest in going back and watching these. First of all, they're too recent. You know, I've seen them. They seem very fresh still. And I just don't... I don't see how that... This goes for Titanic, too. I just don't see how that really... Are we just going to re-release everything in 3D? I mean...
I suspect... Yeah. And I've heard different views on Titanic in 3D. I've heard the Titanic 3D was a Titanic mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that it's a great experience.
Right.
So I don't know who to believe. I'll check it out. Because I know that it's criticized a lot, and I know that it has flaws, but I do think Titanic is a great movie experience.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm glad I saw it. I mean, I have no regrets about that. But I mean, are they going to do is Coppola going to come back and do The Godfathers and all of them in 3D? I mean, you know?
I bought those. I bought those on Blu-ray. $25 for the box set. I was excited.
No, that's awesome.
Amazon was having a sale the other day, so I was like, I can't. That's an offer I can't refuse.
No, that is an offer you cannot refuse. I mean, I have that trilogy of VHS, DVD, and Blu-ray.
Yeah. Etch-a-Sketch. I can watch it on my
Etch-a-Sketch.
Every single format possible. HBO reviews are coming out of HBO's movie, premieres the first week of March, I think, Game Change.
March 12th, I think, is the... I think March 12th. I'm not positive.
Like I said, March 12th. Julianne Moore as Sarah Palin, Ed Harris as John McCain, Woody Harrelson as the aide. I mean, what a great cast, just like HBO. They say it's not likely to gain support of, you know, the Republican Party.
No, but it sounds fascinating. I'm looking forward to it.
But they do say it's, yeah, they do say it's a movie of great performances. So that's coming soon. And then HBO has something with Clive Owen and Nicole Kidman.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I heard about this, yeah.
Clive Owen plays Hemingway.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
I think it's a good director, too. I'll look up the director, but that's a good project. And then we're still waiting to hear, it's supposed to be this airing in the summer, the Pacino, David Mamet, Phil Spector movie. That's
right,
still,
yeah.
Still untitled. Haven't even found a title for it. Phil Spector was just denied today, or this week, for a retrial.
Okay, well,
yeah.
You know.
They're just not buying the crazy.
No.
What is this movie? Hemingway and Gellhorn. It is directed by, wait for it, Philip Kaufman.
Good. All right, good. Glad to see he's doing something.
Wow, Philip Kaufman. Look at how HBO does this. Philip Kaufman directing Clive Owen, Nicole Kidman, and Robert Duvall.
That should be good. That should be very good.
What a project.
Definitely.
And then you have, you know, Luck, which I haven't had much luck getting into.
I haven't checked it out yet, so.
It is slow going. I mean, I know of a slow burn, but really, I mean, this is too much. okay. Anything else going on? What comes out this weekend? You watching anything this weekend?
This weekend you actually do have an interesting wide release movie, and it's called Act of Valor. And I'm curious only because now this is what I don't understand, and maybe you can help me out here. Now, are they actual Navy SEALs that are they ex Navy SEALs, or are they Navy SEALs that are actually Navy, like they're still Navy SEALs? Now, that's what I don't understand.
Are they active? You know, I think they're active.
Okay.
But this is what you have. You have a movie that promises authenticity because, I mean, everything was kind of passed through the actual people that run missions like this.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but they perform in the movie.
Right.
So, but is it when they're so intricately part of it.
Right.
I mean, is it like basically a showreel for the Navy?
Right, yeah, for the Navy. I agree.
Is it going to play like a movie or an infomercial?
That's the big thing. That's the big question. But it's a curiosity. But I, like I said, I got to be the next big thing. I mean, the first maybe big film of this year is going to probably be The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
I mean, and the
I didn't read the books, but the books are so wildly popular. I think people are going to flock to it.
Yeah, I think that's really the big thing. I think John Carter may very well be the first big dud.
Oh yeah.
I
think without a doubt it will be. But here's a movie that I saw. We can talk about this and then we'll close out the show.
Okay.
I did see Chronicle.
What now? Okay, I have to tell you a story about this.
Okay.
Before you, and I'm sure, my brother took his daughter to see this. She's 11. She got very disturbed by the scene where they go into the cave and they had to leave. Now,
mm-hmm.
I think I've seen the movie, and I thought it was very interesting. But there's a scene in that movie that takes place at a party. No one in the right mind would take their kid to see this movie. Oh, do you know what I'm talking about?
So you're saying your brother's not in his right mind?
No, his ex-wife wanted to take her to see Contagion, okay? I was like, really? You want to take the kid to see Contagion? I mean,
yeah. You're building an antisocial monster.
I know, I mean, but I understood that. And I was actually, I was impressed. Right, that disturbed her, okay. But I was thinking about it then after my brother told me, like, oh my God, thank God they left when they did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what did you think of it?
Well, I went in with high elevated expectations because I kept hearing this is a great sci-fi movie.
This is
like our Matrix. It came out of nowhere. this little movie,
mm-hmm.
and it really excited people. It's made a lot of money based on budget, and it's inventive. I did not like it because I saw the possibilities of it in that it's a great dark story.
Right.
And it owes a lot to Carrie because
it does. You're right.
If you look at Carrie and you update it for today, today's age where we're aware of school violence, we're aware of Columbine. I mean, it's a different culture now.
Mm-hmm.
And you put a character like Carrie in today's culture, you know, I think that's an interesting, really dark world to explore. I felt that character's journey.
Mm-hmm.
I think that all of that promise was completely squelched by the found footage format.
Yeah.
It did nothing for me, the found footage. Because at least in Paranormal Activity movies, some times maybe 10-15% of the time, it's pretty ridiculous. Why would anybody be holding a camera? But you always know who's holding the camera. It's motivated somewhat. It never kind of comes out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely comes out of nowhere. And this, I mean, the use of the camera held in the participants' hands is so completely unmotivated.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times, laughable times, when the camera shows up. Why the heck is there a camera set up on a tripod at the foot of his hospital bed when he's sitting there like he's in a coma?
I think that's one of the problems. I mean, I like the film a little bit more than you do, but I do agree. It is the found footage thing does hurt it at times. I think the problem with the film is the third act, though. The film goes exactly where you know it's going to go, and I think that the third act is it's a superhero film.
Well, yes, it starts, but I didn't have a problem. I knew where it was going to go. I knew that it was going to mean his demise, and his friend would have to fight him before he, you know. But I just think it was so completely squandered by that format. And why did she, you know, I didn't like that aspect of it at all. And I got in a little tiff with somebody on Twitter that said he rides the trend of found footage movie. He does something with that no one's ever done, which is the floating camera where he controls it telekinetically, where he places the camera where he wants. Yes, it's inventive in a scene or two, not throughout the entire movie. And plus, he doesn't break the trend. It's still a found footage movie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, it's still fundamentally what it is.
Right.
And so because of the ridiculousness of that approach, it starts out as something that could have been a very dark, Carrie-esque movie, and it ends almost like a parody of Superman 2.
That's true.
The ending reminded me of Superman 2. It was much better, and I was more invested in it in Superman 2.
No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, there are parts of it I really like, you do see the limitations of the genre. I mean, you really do.
And plus, I could see the calculation behind it. I could see, all right, what's popular now? Comic book movies and found footage movies. Let's see if we can combine the two. Do it cheaply and make a lot of money. And I think that they're trying to find something new to do with the found footage because, I do think that the director probably has a lot of talent. And I think he was probably constricted by this idea, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I wasn't taken by it. I wanted to be, but
I hear you. Yeah, no, I understand.
The theater I went to was gorgeous. Like AMC had this new diner theater. Dine-in theater. And I've been to like Mugs of Movies and stuff, but this was like completely upscale, like the reserved seating kind of thing, and it was nice.
That sounds very is this in your neck of the woods or
it's in Orlando.
Okay.
But I was
it near Harry Potter World?
Yes, it's the thrust of that.
It
it's weird that the Chronicle was the movie they were showing there in that theater. But it was interesting because we ordered food and they kept bringing us more. Like, we ordered large popcorn. I ordered some, like, mozzarella sticks.
Mm-hmm.
We all had beer. And then they came with two additional large popcorns, had, like, four waters. Are you guys trying to, like, stuff us to death or something?
Yeah, I know,
what's
really.
What's going on? I am not paying for this because this will be, like, a second mortgage, but, yeah. All right. Rick Waite. What a great segue.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Waite, we spoke to him last summer for our Summer of 86 series. We'll be picking that up again this summer, Summer of 87. But Summer of 86 was the year of a lot of fun movies, one of which I always had a great time with, is Cobra. So I had to explore Cobra because it's one of my greatest guilty pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Waite is the cinematographer of Cobra. He also shot, a litany of classic 80s films. 48 Hours.
Oh, wow.
Footloose. Red Dawn. On and on and on. He rarely did interviews. He did an interview with us. And I remember talking to him, and afterwards, I guess our phone cut off near the end of the conversation. We weren't able to say goodbye or finish this thought that he had. It just kind of cut off. Block Talk Radio cut us off. I said, I'm so sorry. I wrote him an email and said, I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened with the technical difficulties. And he wrote back and said, no, I had a wonderful time, actually. And he started typing out the end of his story that he started to tell me on the air. But he was a great guy. He passed away at the age of 78 this past weekend. And so I thought I'd close the show, or we close the show tonight, with a snippet of our conversation with him from that show. If you want to hear the show, it's in our archives, and you can actually find it at moviegeeksunited.net/featured, our Summer of 86 series. It's the Cobra Show. This was a juicy, juicy show.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. So we're going to close off with the snippet of conversation with Rick Waite, and then we'll be back Sunday for our pre-Oscar show.
Yeah, cool.
If you missed any part of Ludovic Borse's interview, you can find it on replay. It'll start again near the beginning of the show. And all of our additional Oscar nominee interviews, you can find at moviegeeksunited.net/Oscar. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Cool.
Jerry?
Thank you. No, it was awesome. Good night, and thanks.
Let me find this file. I was hoping you'd take a little longer with your
goodbye. No, thanks for joining us. So, yeah, and your last-minute Oscar predictions, too, on Sunday.
On Sunday, yeah, the last chance we have. All right, here's Mr. Waite. Good night, everybody.
All right, good night.
Did the Cobra project come about for you in the usual way, or...?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the director, it was a strange dude. His name is George Cosmatos. We mm-hmm. called him George Comatose. Because for the most part, he really was. George would have made a great producer. He's a terrible director. Mm-hmm. He knows nothing, has no technical knowledge whatsoever at all. He could never understand why we had to get focus marks. I truly did not understand that, the concept. Sly was a pretty good guy to work with, pretty good sense of humor. The problem we had with Sly was he was engaged at that time to Brigida, whatever her name was. And she was in the movie, of course, and they were all playing grab ass and kissy facey and poo poo and all that kind of stuff. And we were losing, and he also had this entourage of, he called them security people. They were just a bunch of muscle men, really, but they were, and they were paid to basically listen to Sly talk. That was the bottom line, which Sly did a lot of. And one day we were shooting, and he comes roaring up to me. He says, "Rick, we're really falling behind. You got to push your crew a little harder." Now I've always been noted in the industry as being one of the fastest cameramen in the industry. I mean, I am fast. I know I am.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't sit around for 20 minutes looking at us. By the time the director says it's yours, and I've seen the rehearsal, I know exactly how to light it. So, and I'm off and running. So, I don't I don't. Anyway, I said, Sly, if you stop playing grab ass with Brigida, you know, and stop, you know, bullshitting with your henchmen, you know, we get off to a much better start here in the morning. And he looked at me like, no one talks to me that way, you know. I thought, well, you know, okay. What? I had two more. Actually, I had two more offers for movies in the bag. Anyway, so if he fired me, I didn't care. But he didn't fire me. He said, okay. And he behaved for about 3 weeks, and then we went back to business as usual, and no one else ever complained again. But other than that, he's a pretty good guy and a good sense of humor. And the only other thing that blew me away was at the end of the big shootout sequence at the end, the third act.
Right.
And we shot it out at Lake Piru. And it was written as a night sequence with all these motorcycles coming up and everybody shooting each other, blah, blah. So we went out there of an evening, and I don't know what time of the year it was. It must have been, you know, November maybe or March, I don't know. But it was pretty cold at night, I got to tell you. You know, I'm a cold California you can get. Anyway, and we're out there in our shirt sleeves. Well, I knew better. I always carry a sweater and a jacket in my car. So I actually had two, so I loaned Sly one of my jackets. We walked around, figured everything out. He says, it's just one thing, he says to George Cosmatos. He says, we're going to shoot because it's a day sequence. And we all looked at each other and said, day? There is nothing scary about Dave. Look at Sly. I mean, you can see him coming from 10 miles away. But, you know, it defeats the entire purpose. I didn't say this. We're all thinking it. But, you know, it was Sly's picture. So we shot it by day.
The whole shootout at the end of it, it was originally conceived for night? Is that what you're saying?
The thing with the motorcycle sequence, not the thing in the fire factory where he finally throws the guy up on the hook. And
right, but when he's on the back of the truck and he's shooting down the bikers.
Yeah, exactly. They were staying in the motel, and
right,
he got shot.
Right.
And that sequence should have been a nice sequence.
You mentioned Cosmatos, who you guys refer to as Cabotos, which is just priceless to me. So in terms of mapping out the shots and the visual scheme of the film, did you feel like you were basically on your own in doing that, or?
Pretty much. I mean, yeah. George would come in every day with comments from the previous day's dailies, and we all knew it was Sly's handwriting. It wasn't George. Now, here's what I looked at dailies last night, and these are my comments. These are my comments, quote unquote. What we, you know, everyone knew it was Sly's comments. It was Sly's handwriting. I mean, that's happened a number of times where I've jokingly said I could probably, you know, claim directing credit for at least 20 movies that they couldn't find a way to the set without a roadmap. Never mind block out a scene. But the good directors, never a problem. Like Walter Hill, Herb Ross. I'll tell you that real the killer was John Frankenheimer. I mean, he's the most cantankerous son of a bitch I've ever met in my life. But what a brilliant director, and I love working with him. And he's just got a great eye. But he put his hands out and said, "This is what I want, Rick." He said, "That's exactly what I want. I don't want anything else, nothing more, nothing less. That's exactly what I want." He's framing it up. Love it.
Tell me about working. I mean, not just with Stallone, but with big actors in general. What is your level of communication with the actor? And I would imagine big stars like a Stallone are very specific about how they want to be lit, how they want to be shot. Is that the case or no?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Like I'm looking at a poster for The Border, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
And Jack was really a great guy. I mean, he was just really a super guy to work with. It was a long time ago, of course, but he... The only quirky thing, he wanted to wear these mirrored sunglasses. And they literally were mirrors. I mean, the side toward the camera. So mm-hmm. It was a nightmare. Every time I said, "Jack, could you just drop your chin a little bit? Because I can see the whole crew, the trucks and everything else in your glasses." I mean, but other than that, the guy was terrific. John Candy, I did 5 pictures with John Candy. One of the great gentlemen of all time. Johnny Forsythe, and John became a very dear friend of our family. As did Johnny Forsythe and Dick Crenna, both became really good family friends with my wife and I and our children and their families. as my wife and I are currently with Kurt and Goldie. We go back with Goldie Hawn 40 years.
Wow.
The night we met Goldie was the evening of the day she was then dating a guy named Gus Tricone. She finally married him after a while, briefly. But at any rate, the day that she signed a contract to do this brand new NBC show called Laugh-In. And it was that day that she had signed the contract to do that show. So that's how far back we go. And we have stayed over the years, and we go back with Kurt. Every one of those people, they're just, I told my students that, they think everybody's running around, you know, on the casting couch and shooting up heroin or smoking dope or whatever have you. I've only seen dope and marijuana on my set once. It was a crew member, and you know, I sent him home right on the spot. But
right.
I said I've never take that back. I mean, David Carradine on Long Riders smoked a lot of dope, but never out publicly, only in his, you know, privately.
Mm-hmm.
He never late for a call and never blew a line for any reason either. So that I
well, that's what when you tell me the stories about the films you've been involved with, and I look at the remainder of your resume. I mean, you've worked with such incredibly talented but very colorful people, and you know, we talked about Frankenheimer and Walter Hill, and they make very kind of muscular, tough movies for the most part. And then I look at someone like John Milius in Red Dawn, who is also that kind of filmmaker. He's a colorful character too, isn't he?
A great big bear. John's favorite on that movie anyway, and I love the man dirty, truly I do. We had a lot of fun on that movie, he and I together. Literally a lot of fun. One night, I mean, we were shooting, we started in September, and we were still shooting in December. It was getting really cold. One night we were shooting, and it was about 25 below zero, I think. Below, I'm talking now, okay? And he had told the UPM, you know, call me when Rick's got the, he'd given the setup the night before. He said, call me when Rick's ready for the shot. So I set up the shot, and I've got two pair of electric socks. I got moon boots up to my knees. I got the Eddie Bauer bib overall pants. I've got long underwear, of course. I've got a turtleneck, a wool sweater, a wool shirt, and Eddie Bauer vest, and that Eddie Bauer Expedition parka. And I got mittens up to run to my. I mean, I was an animated igloo is what I was. Everybody's the same thing. Anyway, I set up the shot. Told the first AD, okay, call John, I'm ready. And now sit down, have a cigarette, cup of coffee, and wait till John gets there. Which I knew, he had some young thing at the hotel. He was probably banging her or something. I don't know if she was banging him. Anyway, he comes roaring up in his car, pulls up right up next to me in the set. He said, okay, Rick, you got 5 minutes, that's all you're going to get. I said, hey, John, you know, that's 25 fucking below zero here. If you don't want to shoot work tonight, well, I'll get you. There's not a man in this crew that won't happen to go back to the hotel and get warm. If you want to call the quits for the night, hey, be my guest. I'll follow you. And he laughed and apologized. He said, I'm sorry, Rick. I had the greatest blowjob of my life. He was just that kind of guy, you know.
When you give examples, for instance, when you taught, when you gave examples of great cinematography, what are some of those films that come to mind for you?
Well, you know, The Bad, the Beautiful. Unfortunately, you know, I still think black and white is the truest art form there is in terms of motion picture. I think color is disappointing at best. Also, the writing in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, I think was just infinitely better than it is today. Now, I have to believe that there's no shortage of good writers. There's just a big shortage of intelligent readers. The studios today are no longer run by filmmakers. They're run by lawyers and accountants. And
yeah,
all they look at is the bottom line. And that's really too bad. But because I've written two scripts where my agent had set out. One went to Paramount, one went to Warner Brothers. I got incredible coverage. Both scripts. I mean, this is a great script, great dialogue, great characters, great plot, blah, 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 blah. Get a star attached, it's a made movie. Now, wait a minute. Get a star attached. If I had Brad Pitt, I could shoot the fucking New York phone book and make a movie out of it. You know, so, I mean, that's the studio's job is to get the star, not the writer, you know. But nobody will read scripts anymore. I don't think anyone ever reads them. They have people who read them, who write the coverage, and the coverage goes up the food chain and finally gets to somebody on top that has the power to say, okay, let's make this movie. I like what it sounds like. You know, and all he's read is the coverage. He's never read the actual script. He just read